Americans spend more money on music at the online iTunes store than any other music retailer. But there are still many people who don't have a home computer to set up an iTunes account. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, a company called Cricket is targeting those consumers with its phone-only music service.
The customers who come to this Cricket store in Washington, D.C. want cell phones that connect to the internet to get their email and stay connected to family and friends. But they aren't willing to pay the prices of many of the carriers, and that's why they come here.
It's cheap. And I have four children.
Cynthia Wilson, a medical assistant in D.C., says her sister, who used to be on Sprint, just moved over to Cricket.
She got tired of paying all that money for the same thing she can get here for $55. She was paying $100 and something. That's ridiculous.
And now for an extra $10, customers here can get an unlimited music plan. That appealed to Carlos Duggar.
Because I love my gospel and my jazz.
Duggar says it's his phone, not his computer, that's his main connection to the internet.
I do use the phone more for internet purpose than I do at home.
And it's people like Duggar who are not focused on their computers who are the target for Cricket's new music service.
Cricket's customers live on their phone. Their phone, not the computer, is the center of their life.
Jeff Toig developed Cricket's music service. Toig says most of Cricket's customers make $50,000 a year or less. The iPhone probably isn't even an option. Toig admits they could choose other music subscription services that cost $10 a month, names like Napster, Rhapsody, and Spotify. But he says those services all require customers to download an app to their phone first.
And the app is less functional. The experience doesn't start on the phone, it starts on the computer, and the phone is an extension. We have taken a fundamentally different approach because our experience is all about the phone.
Cricket's music service is built in, and it gives its customers access to millions of songs ranging from the work of great gospel singers.
The Battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Lord, it was the Battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Hallelujah.
To independent artists.
Give up acting tough. It's all that I'm made of.
Two hits from major labels.
I'm beautiful in my way. Just gotta make no mistakes. I'm on the right track. Baby, I was born this way.
It's surprising in some ways that the big record labels went along with Cricket. They've been notoriously skeptical of online plans. But Michael Nash, a vice president for digital strategies at Warner Music, says the typical Cricket customer burns friends' CDs and listens to radio.
So you've got a situation where you don't have, you know, a great legitimate music proposition, and you don't have a very convenient proposition.
Nash says by creating a music service for the phone, Cricket has tapped into many customers who might not have paid anything at all for digital music. Although the service is phone-based, salespeople at Cricket like to point out that it can easily be used to entertain at home. Sean Burrows, assistant manager at the Cricket store in D.C., shows off a speaker that can connect to the phone.
Kind of like you have a party in your pocket, basically. So this thing is able to, like I said, you get a lot of sound in a small space.
What's your name?
My name is Kerry. I'm so very...
But there are skeptics who don't think this phone really adds much to what's already out there. Amari Love, an analyst at Morningstar, says pretty much all phones now have internet access, and that's really all you need to have a phone with music.
Even playlists, I mean, you can set those up via YouTube. And I can't remember the last handset that didn't have access to that. So it's really about, I'm actually kind of struggling with what real value the Move product is going to add.
And Love thinks there's a limited market for low-cost phone services. However, since Cricket added what it's calling Move Music a little over 5 months ago, it's garnered more than 100,000 users. 50,000 of those customers are completely new to Cricket's phone service. And it may be that in a time when the economy and Americans are struggling, a low-cost service may hit the spot for a growing number of people. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Earlier this week, the online gossip site Gawker reported that one of the GOP presidential candidates, Newt Gingrich, may have bought most of the 1.3 million followers of his Twitter account. Gingrich's campaign vigorously denies the accusation, but the controversy got us wondering if Twitter users can actually buy followers. As NPR's Hanzi Lo Wang reports, they sure can.
Full disclosure, I have a Twitter account. How many followers? 0, which can make you feel a bit inadequate when you're sized up next to Twitter heavyweights like Britney Spears with 8.8 million followers, and Twitter mother monster herself, Lady Gaga, with 12.2 million. Yes, I know I'm not a pop music sensation, but even NPR's very own,
I'm Scott Simon,
has more than a million followers. Still, fellow lonely Twitter users, don't fret. If your tweets aren't enticing enough fans, you can always pay Jake Shinkin to do the job. Shinkin's a co-owner of Twitter1K.com, an online service that's boosted Twitter follower counts for clients ranging from social media newbies to celebrities to
major clothing lines launching a new product to Christian groups looking for a bigger outreach.
For a little less than $25, Shinkin says his company can take your Twitter follower count from 0 to 1,000. His biggest complaint so far from customers who go to his company's website?
Speed. Often people think if I type in my credit card number, I can have 2,000 followers in an hour.
Shinkin says that quick of a turnaround is impossible given Twitter's spam filters, but fork over about $45 and his company will guarantee 2,000 followers in 20 to 30 days. How did they do it? Shinkin says Twitter1K.com promotes clients' Twitter accounts to other Twitter users with similar interests, with the end goal of getting them to follow their clients. If you're wondering if Shinkin's company has any competitors, there are plenty. Just Google the phrase, how to buy Twitter followers.
Here at YouSocial, we know the secrets to making you an overnight rock star on Twitter.
And those secrets can cost you thousands of dollars if you want to go into really big numbers of followers, say a few hundred thousand. Peter Shankman advises companies on social media strategies, and he says the secret to gathering Twitter followers en masse begins with pinpointing the most common Twitter user. You know, the one that signs up for an account and then never tweets?
People will reach out to these people and say, hey, you know, if you start following this person, I'll give you a penny, or I'll give you a coupon, or follow these 100 people, I'll give you a dollar. A dollar is something of value to a lot of people, so they'll say, okay, this doesn't cost me anything. Click, click, click. They follow those people.
And Shankman says that payout to followers has a payoff for the client.
You get these really, really big numbers in your Twitter follower count, but they're useless numbers. You're speaking into an open cavern and no one's listening.
Although a large Twitter follower count might catch the eye of anyone who's trying to measure popularity. Newt Gingrich recently called attention to his Twitter account, saying he has 6 times as many Twitter followers as all the other current GOP presidential hopefuls combined. But Shankman says numbers can be deceiving.
10 years ago, it was the number of page views you had in your website. 30 years ago, it was the subscription numbers you had or the size or square footage of your house. But in the concept of Twitter, numbers only tell a very small part of the story.
And any legitimate Twitter story is built tweet by tweet. Hanzi Luong, NPR News.
Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Coming up, we'll talk about the perks the millennial generation wants on the job and how employers are working to meet them halfway. But first, you've been telling your friends not to post those silly photos of themselves clutching brimming beer mugs or worse, posting angry or threatening status updates. Now that may be coming back to haunt them, thanks to the Social Intelligence Corporation. The company searches everything you've done publicly online for the past 7 years and reports back to prospective employers. But will the increasingly blurred lines between our social and work lives end up costing you a job? To talk about the rising use of social media background checks, we invited Max Drucker, CEO and co-founder of Social Intelligence Corporation, and John Verdi, the Senior Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
So, Max, let me start with you. If you've got the skills, you're qualified for the job, you're not doing anything illegal, why does it matter what you're doing on Facebook or Twitter or whatever?
Well, Social Intelligence Corp only looks for employer predefined criteria. And that criteria is racist remarks, potentially violent behavior, illegal activity such as drug use and sexually explicit material. We do not look or report on anything else, so that job applicant really is able to have a robust and strong online presence without fearing being discriminated against based on some post of them drinking beer, or even worse, something that such as them being a single mom and that coming back to haunt them because an employer made a hiring decision illegally based on that information.
So what kind of activities do you look at, and where do you look for them?
We look both on the major social networks, but we also look broader to the message boards, to comments on news articles, to the photo and video sharing sites. And we are looking for very specific things. We are looking for people that make blatantly racist statements. We are looking for people that are flagrantly displaying a weapon, an assault rifle, pointing it at the camera.
Wait, let me ask you a question, though. I mean, because assault rifles are legal in some places, so why is that a problem?
Well, the employer has the right, and the employer chooses what we are to look for. And if an employer is not concerned about that, we don't identify it. To answer the question about why this may be relevant, that's up to the employer. But an argument they may make is, well, this isn't illegal, and this is their right to do. They may not feel that a person is representing them the way that company would want them to represent themselves publicly.
John, let me bring you into the conversation, because the idea of poring over someone's internet footprint can be alarming to some privacy advocates. But if it's stuff that you have publicly put out there yourself, why is it a privacy issue?
Well, I think it is alarming. I think the reality is that these sorts of social media background checks are here to stay, regardless of whether it's social intelligence, whether it's employers doing this work themselves, or whether it's another service. So the reason why one might be concerned about this sort of social background check is that many social profiles on Facebook, Google+, Twitter are necessarily incomplete. Individuals use their privacy settings to reveal some information to the public and to not reveal other information to the public.
Right.
To take your example of an individual with an assault rifle, if you were to take a photograph of an individual with an assault rifle and you take that photograph out of context and you put it in a background check report, what you don't learn is that that individual was recently discharged from the Marine Corps, that photograph was taken while they were stationed overseas in Iraq. And the employer has no way to know that, nor does social intelligence have any way to know that, unless the individual has revealed other information about themselves beyond the photograph on a social networking site. So context is important.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with John Verde, Senior Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. I'm also joined by Max Drucker, CEO and co-founder of Social Intelligence Corporation. Let me ask you both a question. Just a couple of years back, anything that you did outside of the workplace pretty much wasn't your boss's business, right? But if you go to pulling people's comments on news stories and checking into whether somebody tried to buy a car or something on Craigslist, that might strike some as a pretty extreme intrusion into your personal life. I mean, it's kind of, as one commentator I saw suggested, like having your boss send someone to the bar you're at, listen to your conversation, and then come back and tell your boss what you said. I mean, John, isn't that kind of like being on the clock 24/7, everything you do and say?
Well, yeah, the legal considerations aside, there's a real human question to ask here. And the question that we need to ask is, do we want to put vastly more information about employees' and job applicants' private lives in front of their employers or prospective employers? And do we want that information to have any kind of relevancy guarantees concerning their employment status, concerning their job description? That's a question that we as a society need to ask ourselves. How much privacy are we willing to give up and put in the hands of our employers who, let's be honest, control our paycheck?
Max, explain why it's okay for a boss to have that level of control over what the employee is doing.
Employers are in a really tough spot in the age of social media. If they're one of the 80% of employers that are doing the internet screen themselves, they are exposing themselves to all kinds of things that aren't legally allowable or frankly not relevant, and thus are violating that job applicant's privacy. But on the other hand, they have an obligation to protect their existing employees against major risks, which really fall into the same categories as why they do the traditional screens, such as criminal and drug. The way we solve this problem is by only identifying predefined criteria and ignore everything else.
Let me ask you, Max, does your company do ongoing monitoring of people or just the one-time background check?
We do ongoing monitoring, but purely to the specifications of enforcing a company's social media policy.
So how is that not basically having somebody standing over said person's shoulder every time they're at the computer?
Well, most corporations or many corporations monitor activity on their internet use and on their computers. But a company has the right to have a social media policy, and that's part of their employee handbook.
John, what kind of different privacy concerns does ongoing monitoring offer, if any?
One of the major risks is that companies' social media policies are often illegally overbroad. There was one example recently in the state of Connecticut where an ambulance worker took to the social media site to complain about her boss, who she believed was endangering workplace safety with some of the decisions that he was making on the job. Now, that sort of speech is actually protected under the National Labor Relations Act. Employees are entitled to talk about workplace safety concerns without penalty and without reprisal. However, she was fired from her job, and the National Labor Relations Board had to intervene. All of those actions by the company were consistent with its social media policy. And that company's social media policy was no employee may post anything on social media about the company.
Let me ask a final question to you both. First, John, if you've got stuff out there that you shouldn't have out there, do you just take it down or do you try and find a way to explain that when you go into the job interview in the first place and try and avoid this? And Max, I want you to answer it after John does.
Well, I think everybody has the right to pull down information that they previously have shared on social media sites. And if someone is going into a job search, I think that they would be wise to do a self-assessment on their social media profile. As to explaining it, I think context is critical. And the real question is whether or not individuals are going to be given a meaningful opportunity to provide that context within the job search.
Max, same question to you. And again, you're going back into 7 years of data, so explain how much saving here people have an opportunity to do.
Well, we can use anything that goes back 7 years, but everything we're still looking at is publicly available. It's what's out there right now. And yes, I totally agree with John. You should do some sort of self-assessment. But I'm also a major advocate that a person can have a very strong online profile and a positive one. And social intelligence also identifies very specific positive criteria for those reports and redacts anything, again, that's not legally allowable.
All right. I've got to leave it there, gentlemen. Max Drucker is co-founder and CEO of Social Intelligence Corporation. He joined us from Santa Barbara, California. John Verdi is senior counsel of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. He joined us from our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you, gentlemen, both for a spirited conversation.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today, we're talking online bullying. Author Rachel Simmons has thought a lot about bullying among girls. In 2002, she wrote a best-selling book about the hidden culture of aggression in girls. It was called Odd Girl Out. And back then, technology had little impact on the subject, but these days, with frantic Facebook stalking, girls sending thousands of text messages a month, and sometimes even sleeping with their cell phones under their pillows, bullies have new ways to reach into girls' worlds. Now Rachel Simmons has updated her book, and she's with us now to explain how online bullying especially affects girls and what girls and their parents can do about this. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why did you decide to update the book?
Well, you can't really talk about girls anymore without talking about the role of social media in their lives. For many girls, technology is not just what connects them, but it's part of their relationships. And so many girls will say, I don't exist if I'm not on Facebook. It's a huge part of how they navigate their lives.
One of the things that is enjoyable about your book is that you have a lot of tales from the front line. You talk to a lot of teenage girls for the first edition and then again for the updated edition. Share with us some of the stories that the girls shared with you about some of their worst online stories about bullying.
Well, I think part of what happens is that girls, because they don't have a lot of communication skills in the real world, lean on social media to navigate their challenges and their conflicts. And so If I'm upset with you and we're both in eighth grade and I don't have the tools to tell you that, I'm going to get on my cell phone. And because I'm not looking you in the eye, I'm going to say terrible things to you. And if I go on Facebook and I say nasty things on your public page, other girls start to see it. And if they want to get involved, they can add what they feel. And the target then begins to feel that not only does everyone hate me, but I can see that. Everyone can see it. And I can't go home. I can't hide from this. I can't close the door on my house and be away and be safe.
Is there one particular story that really stays with you?
You know, I think the story of a girl who was perceived by another girl stealing a boyfriend. And she received scores of messages all night long, vicious messages for so many girls and children, period. You don't think it can end. You can't see a time where your phone won't be buzzing. And so she actually attempted to take her own life because she really felt helpless. And this is a story we continue to see in the headlines.
You know that social media can bring out the worst in all of us, adults included. So what can adults do to turn this around, to try to protect children or control this in some way?
Well, you're exactly right. It brings out the worst in us, and therefore we've got to look at our own habits of social media use. How many times have I watched children with their parents, and their parents are deeply engaged in their cell phones and not paying attention to their children? Certainly parents need to look at themselves. I think it's also important to start saying no and not believing that this technology tidal wave is just coming and you have to give into it.
Now, you had some other advice that was included in the book about where to keep the cell phone, when a child can use the cell phone. Let's tick through some of that.
Definitely. Your child should not be sleeping with her cell phone. Give her a stuffed animal. I once met a mom who said to me that she slept with both of her teenage children's laptops underneath her pillow at night because it was the only way she knew that they wouldn't come and steal them. And I think you've got to do whatever you can do. If you don't trust your child, you've got to keep her out of trouble by sometimes taking things away.
That doesn't necessarily sound comfortable, but I guess it worked for her.
I guess it worked for her. It's a last resort. I don't suggest it as a first step.
You also say that it's a good idea to create a cell phone parking area, a place in the home where all cell phones, including those belonging to the parents, should be parked at the end of the day.
Exactly. Mealtimes, times where the family is together, homework time. Last I checked, you don't need to text in order to do your homework. So I can tell you, having just spent the summer with many girls at the Girls Leadership Institute summer camp that I help run, the girls talk about how they don't know how to say to their friends, pay attention to me, stop texting. Having those girls not be online for their summer, they actually thank us. They say, you know, it's good to be offline. We can do a great service to them by simply showing them that time offline actually really is healthy.
I used to tell girls don't share mascara or lip gloss. Now you tell them don't share your password.
Oh, yes. Let's add password to mascara and lip gloss. You know, a lot of girls think you're my best friend and I want to share everything with you and I'm going to share that password. And what I say to girls is you've got to treat your password like a credit card. That is not something you share with a close friend. And so it's a great way to teach girls to set boundaries and say no. And you can tell your daughter, if worse comes to worse, blame it on me. Tell your friend I made you change your password and keep it private.
Rachel Simmons, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Simmons. She's the author of Odd Girl Out, The Hidden Culture of Aggression in Girls. It was first published in 2002, and it's now been revised and updated for the digital world.